Well, from the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. We'll have some holiday open lines for you later tonight. And I'm going to save my Thanksgiving hello to all of you for tomorrow night's show, because we will be live here on Thanksgiving night. Here's some quick news of the day. Al-Qaeda in Iraq has denied that its leader, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, was among those killed in a weekend raid and gunfight in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul. The statement, posted on an Islamic website that often carries militant reports, came a day after a top U.S. commander in Iraq said that he has absolutely no reason to believe that al-Zarqawi had died. The insurgents' denial followed a fierce gun battle between Iraqi and U.S. soldiers on Saturday after the coalition forces received tips that he might have been inside of a house there. Three insurgents detonated explosives and killed themselves to avoid capture. Five more died in fighting, according to the U.S. military. Gunmen dressed as Iraqi troops stormed the home of a senior Sunni leader, killing him, his three sons, and a son-in-law. Neighbors told authorities that at least 10 vehicles that appeared to be Iraqi army stopped outside of the western Baghdad house of a sheikh of the Sunni tribe before gunmen went inside the home and shot the men. According to the Associated Press, they say that the Iraqi military denies that it was any of their soldiers. Britain has warned media organizations that they are breaking the law if they published details of a leaked document said to show President George W. Bush wanted to bomb the Arabic television station Al Jazeera. The government's top lawyer warned editors in a note after the Daily Mirror newspaper reported that a secret British government memo said that British Prime Minister Tony Blair had talked Bush out of the bombing in that situation last April. Several British newspapers reported the Attorney General's note on Tuesday and repeated the Mirror's allegations. The White House says they were outlandish. Thousands of low-income Massachusetts residents will receive a discounted home heating oil this winter under an agreement signed with Venezuela, whose government is a political adversary of the Bush administration. Now, a subsidiary of Venezuela's state-owned oil company will supply oil at 40% below market prices. It will be distributed by two nonprofit organizations, Citizens Energy Corp and Mass Energy Consumer Alliance. The agreement gives President Hugo Chavez's government standing as a provider of heating assistance to poor U.S. residents at a time when the U.S. oil companies have been reluctant to do so. This is an incredible story. Congress has failed to expand aid in response to rising oil prices. A U.S. Representative, William Delahunt, Democrat of Massachusetts, met with Chavez in August and helped broker the deal. He said his constituents' needs for heating assistance trump any political points the Chavez administration can score. China reported its second confirmed death from a strain of the bird flu that has claimed more than 67 lives in Asia. State media reported that a bird flu vaccine being developed in China now would be tested on 100 people. It's already been tried on minks, chickens, and rats. Well, I leave Los Angeles for the holidays and I come to St. Louis. St. Louis has been hit by an earthquake, 2.5. It is the biggest in 30 years to hit up this way. You know, we're on the outskirts of the New Madrid Fault here. Dozens of St. Louis area residents reported feeling weak shaking with no damage. The magnitude 2.5 occurred at 11:05 p.m. Central Time on Tuesday, and it had some rumbling to it, and I think I heard it last night, but I thought it was more of a car. I guess not, because that happened about the same time. Very strange things are going on. There have been 28 earthquakes, small ones, very small ones, along the New Madrid Fault beginning in 2005. A St. Louis University geologist, his name is Timothy Kusky. Well, he's created quite a furor. He was interviewed on CBS's 60 Minutes, and he said New Orleans is sinking and should be rebuilt elsewhere. In the Sunday program, Kusky was quoted as saying New Orleans in 90 years will be a fishbowl surrounded by the Gulf of Mexico because New Orleans is going to be 15 to 18 feet below sea level. Sitting off the coast of North America, surrounded by a 50 to 100-foot tall levee system just to protect the city. Before the program aired, the hurricane recovery chief for Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco said that 60 Minutes should hold that segment, saying that there were many scientists who disagreed with Kuski's comments. A Japanese space probe successfully landed and then departed from the surface of an asteroid, despite an initial announcement that the attempt had failed. The officials of the Japanese Space Agency, they call it JAXA, said that the Hayabusa probe, on a mission to briefly land on an asteroid, collect material, and then bring it back to Earth, had failed to touch down after maneuvering within yards of the asteroid's surface. But later, apparently the data sent from Hayabusa confirmed that it had actually landed on the asteroid for about half an hour. However, the probe failed to collect material. Well, we're going to check in with Coast to Coast Science Advisor Richard C. Hoagland and find out what he, the head of the EnterpriseMission.com, has to say about this Japanese asteroid lander and some other issues right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, his name is Richard C. Hoagland, and he's the founder and principal investigator of the Enterprise Mission, a public policy and research group that's been investigating the scientific possibility of intelligently designed extraterrestrial artifacts across the solar system for years now. Richard has previously served as museum curator of astronomy and space science advisor to Walter Cronkite and CBS News, head of the special projects at New York's Hayden Planetarium, and NASA consultant to the Goddard Space Flight Center. In addition, Richard is the author of The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever, winner of the Engstrom Medal for Excellence in Science, and now we can add to his repertoire the Coast to Coast Science Advisor, Richard C. Hoagland. Hello, Richard. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, George, and good evening, everyone.
You too. Boy, lots of things going on in space that still never stops, does it?
It's the never-ending story, and it's going to only get better and better. You know, we're halfway to Mars, as you know, with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And I was reading some of the specs today, and if they give us half of what they can do, we are going to be mind-blown with the images next year.
They say that that orbiter will provide more data than all the probes combined. That's incredible.
Well, there's a simple reason for that. It carries on board an experimental new communication system, which is able to send data at a much higher bit rate than all the previous probes we've sent beginning back in the 1960s. And the bit rate is equivalent to the speed of your modem. It's like going from dial-up to a DSL or broadband. So that's why we're going to get a lot more data. And the telescope and camera on this spacecraft literally can resolve things the size of my book. Notice the plug there for my book?
Yes.
On the surface of Mars from over 200 miles in space.
Well, let's talk about that in a second, Richard. We're going to keep you this entire hour. You're not going to get away this time. I'm going to work you this holiday.
Oh, really?
Yes, I think I will. But this Japanese probe, how in the heck could they say that they lost it, it failed, and then all of a sudden it miraculously appears, and they say it landed, and now apparently it's taken off but didn't collect any samples? I don't understand.
Do you know how hard it is to find out what's going on with a space agency on the other side of the planet in a different culture with a different language?
Yeah, that's true. It's hard enough to know.
Behind or ahead, I guess, you know, compared to Washington.
Yeah.
I've spent most of the day working this problem, given the fact that you wanted to do something tonight, and I've got some answers for you.
Okay.
And the very simple answer is that it all comes back to that bitrate thing I talked about a moment ago. This spacecraft in particular, Hayabusa, which means falcon in Japanese, is currently station keeping a few miles away from this asteroid, Itokawa, which is named after the equivalent of the Japanese Wernher von Braun, the father of their space program.
Okay.
And it is communicating from beyond the orbit of Mars. It's on the other side of the solar system from us. It's almost behind the sun. So it takes 60 minutes for the radio signals to get from here to there or there to here. And so you have to send the data back by means of a high-gain focused antenna, like a searchlight beam.
All right.
It also has other antennas on it that are called omnidirectional, that broadcast literally in every direction. The difference being that if you're in the beam with a high-gain antenna, you can send data, you can send pictures, you can send engineering, you can send housekeeping, you can keep track of what's going on moment by moment, second by second, millisecond by millisecond. And if that beam turns off the Earth and you have to fall back on those little omni-antennas, the signal quality goes down to basically a tin can and a string, a very long string. So what happened is, as this spacecraft was autonomously, under its own computer control, lowering itself gently at a few inches per second down to touchdown and to get a sample, it had to turn mechanically to orient itself so that it was horizontal to the surface coming up to meet it.
All right.
And that turned the antenna off the Earth. This was all expected. So what they do is they record the data on board. Backup. NASA spacecraft have done it for decades. Japanese are no worse than we are. In fact, in some cases, seem to be somewhat better. So they record all this in terms of solid-state memory on board, right?
Right. And in the old days, didn't they used to do this with real old audio tape?
Tape recorders, yes.
Yeah. That was...
Which could get stuck.
Yes.
Voyager and Galileo had tape recorders, and the Galileo tape recorder actually had some problems, and they had to do long-distance troubleshooting with a mechanical tape drive. Anyway, this is all solid state. The problem was not in the data. The problem was not in the mission. The problem was in turning that antenna, which they had to do, off the Earth. So they did not know anything except for the what they call a Doppler plot. When you send out radio signals from spacecraft, they're on a certain frequency. And like standing on a railway siding, when a train comes toward you, and you get that, the Doppler effect will shift the frequency higher when something's approaching you and down in pitch when it's going away. So the only way they were able to monitor 60 minutes after it all happened, remember, what was going on with this spacecraft was by watching the frequency pitch of the radio signal itself coming back from across the solar system. And in watching this, they were trying to reconstruct what the spacecraft was doing, and it turned out they failed miserably for a couple of really cute coincidences. Remember you said you don't believe a long time ago in anything like coincidence?
I say it all the time. That's right.
There are coincidences. Let me tell you one of the really bad coincidences that happened, you know, on Saturday during the mission.
Okay.
We're on the Earth and it's rotating, right? Which means if you are getting a signal back from space, deep space, at some point the object in deep space that you're looking at is going to set below the western horizon, which means if you want to track it continuously, you have to have antennas spaced around the Earth that can hand off to each other like a relay race.
And like we did during the Apollo moon missions.
And during the unmanned Voyagers and Mars observers and all that.
Okay.
They were borrowing one of NASA's deep space antennas, and just as this spacecraft was to touch down, they had a handoff because of this rotation thing from the Goldstone station to the Japanese deep space station. And it was in that handoff that they missed the key event in the Doppler, which was that the spacecraft kept going down, 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 and ultimately landed on the asteroid. And they're watching when they get their signal back up in the Japanese station. It's already happened. The onboard data has not been sent home yet because there's no antenna to do it.
Right.
So they're watching this Doppler thing, and it's constant, constant, constant. And they think that their spacecraft is hovering over the asteroid for some mysterious reason, when in fact it had touched down. In fact, George, it bounced 3 times very, very gently, because the gravity field of this thing is like 1/10,000th of the gravity keeping you and me in our chairs right now.
And it stayed there about a half hour, and then
it stayed about
half
an hour, and, you know, about the 60 minutes, you know, the signal got back to Earth, and they're watching the temperatures, and they're rising and rising, And the scientists are saying, well, we can't, you know, and the engineers are saying, well, we can't let this thing hover because they think it's still hovering. So they sent a command from Earth to basically tell it, leave, get out of there, you know, so that your temperatures go back to normal. And it took 16 minutes, you know, for the signal to get out slowly to Iatoka and be received by the spacecraft, which acted upon it, fired its little jets, and unbeknownst to them, rose in a cloud of dust from the surface of the asteroid and ultimately wound up 100 kilometers, 62 miles away, spinning slowly in what's called safe mode. They didn't find out until like 24 hours later when they'd reestablished the antennas and downloaded all this data on the onboard computer, all the real things that actually had happened, and that they had made the first successful touchdown and relaunch of any human spacecraft from any asteroid object in the solar system for the first time in history.
That's exciting. Now, will they go back with this probe and try to land again, or is that it?
No, they're planning to go back because what they want to do is they want to land in a program fashion where they stick this stovepipe, basically, into the surface, fire a little gun inside it, which is supposed to kick up dust into some capsules that will then be sealed and carry about a gram of the asteroid material back to Earth for July reentry next year over the Woomera field in the middle of Australia. Before they can do that, they, of course, need to go back and try to get a sample. Now, this afternoon we learned that because when you land a 1,500-pound spacecraft on this asteroid with no gravity, you probably kicked up a whole lot of dust.
Right.
They think that they already got some material stuck up in that stovepipe collector and into one of the capsules that's sitting there like a cartridge in a revolver ready to receive it. So they've sent commands to close the door on that capsule, assuming they've already got stuff stuck inside. And they'll do a deliberate effort to get another sample later in the week, maybe the day after Thanksgiving. November 25th is what they're aiming for, and they've actually reserved time on the NASA Deep Space Network again for downlink of the data. And this time, hopefully, they will plan it so that they don't have a handoff in the middle of the critical part of the mission.
Gosh, I hope they don't bring back some dangerous microbe of some sort.
Well, you know, that's a whole other discussion, and that applies to the NASA Stardust mission of last year. It applies to the Japanese mission. We can get into this when we have more time after the break. If these objects, these asteroids, are not the primordial objects that never made planets, which is the standard NASA model, but instead they're the fragments of a planet that blew up, which is Van Flander to my model, then they could have once had incredibly active, interesting biospheres. They would be loaded with microbes, freeze-dried in the vacuum of space. And you're absolutely right. These capsules containing little tiny amounts that enter the atmosphere and are picked up should be dealt with like the capsule on the Andromeda Strain, that very classic famous movie of 40-some years ago, because they could be carrying diseases that, you know, theoretically we would have no defenses against. So you add that to the avian flu thing and that'll do three or four shows for you.
Absolutely. Well, I guess you could say this thing was successful then, though.
Well, it looks like it was successful because of the incredible redundancy and the resiliency of the spacecraft and this team. I mean, this Japanese team just doesn't know the word quit, which, of course, is Anglo-American, so maybe they don't know it. They just keep going and going and going, and I think they're going to be successful because when you read the Japanese blogs, which is impossible for me because I don't read Japanese, but I found an incredible English translation on a place called Fifth Star. And all of this is linked up at the top of the Enterprise mission website. And you can actually go and see a picture of this spacecraft, this Hayabusa spacecraft hovering above the asteroid with the sun glint behind it and the shadow with the solar panels on the surface and the little white marker ball that they dropped as a target. You can actually see that on the Enterprise site.
Yeah, very clear picture.
Stunningly clear pictures compared to certain other, you know, asteroid comet missions that we've discussed on this program before. Just follow along, and there will be, you know, data coming out, and I think they're going to make it. I think they're going to actually get definite samples, And then by the first week in December, they have to fire the engines to start the trip back to Earth, because unless they leave at a certain time, the spacecraft doesn't have enough xenon fuel to make it back to Earth in the time that has been allotted.
Well, when we come back, Richard, I want to talk about the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and also divine intelligence, because the Vatican has made a statement or two about this, and I want to get your take on it. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment. Richard C. Hoagland's website, enterprisemission.com. I'll tell you a little bit about his work on God, Man, and E.T. when we come back as well. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. With our guest this hour, Richard C. Hoagland, enterprisemission.com, our science advisor. We'll take a few of your calls with him, and I'll continue the dialogue. We're also going to talk about divine intelligence when we come right back. You know, this intelligent design concept that has been going all around the country now, even the Vatican has stepped in to talk about it. We'll get Richard's reaction to what the Vatican had to say. But some time ago, Richard produced an excellent series called, a DVD series called God, Man, and E.T., and it's all about intelligent design. You can get it in time for Christmas, or you can just keep it for yourself. A couple ways to get it, of course. There's a toll-free number. Let me give it to you right now. Write it down as well. 877-345-6222. That's 877-345-6222. You can also go to the enterprisemission.com website and get some more information on the very critically acclaimed DVD series, God, Man, and E.T. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Richard, did you hear what the Vatican had to say about intelligent design about a week ago? They simply said that it should not be conducted in the science rooms of schools, that if they're going to talk about it at all, they should do it in history classes and things like that, but it's not science. What's your take on that?
Well, this was the head of the Vatican Observatory, which is the facility that's both at Castel Gandolfo, south of Rome, and also runs the very strange and mysterious facility in Arizona that everybody always wonders, what's the Vatican Patton Observatory doing in Arizona? He was speaking for himself. He wasn't speaking for the church. Because remember, the Pope, the week before, had made some comments that were widely seen as supporting the idea of intelligent design, where he said something to the effect that the universe wasn't randomly thrown together, it was designed.
Right.
Which is a interesting choice of words in the middle of the court cases and all that.
Are they playing good cop, bad cop with us?
I think so. Yeah. I think Coyne, who is the director of the observatory, is trying to stay with his professional colleagues scientific. And remember, it's what the Pope says that really counts. So.
Yeah, the buck stops there.
The buck does stop at that desk.
Well, I tell you, I had a tremendous response to our roundtable discussion on intelligent design that we had several weeks ago. What
well,
kind
we
of feedback
all have. Mike
Heiser's
gotten a lot of very positive mail. In fact, Mike, if I can talk to him over the air, there is a major university, George, now, that apparently is interested in having us come and do it for them. Do the thing we did at the University of Wisconsin a couple of years ago.
Excellent.
Which is part of this DVD set. And what I would like to do tonight is to kind of issue you a semi-formal invitation to come and be our master of ceremonies.
Well, do you know when this might be?
Nope.
Okay.
But
well, why don't you keep in touch with me?
Next year.
All right. If I can do it for you, I'll do it.
That would be terrific. And Stan will be part of it, Stan Tenen, Mike, myself, and we'll have one of the leading lights in intelligent design, some of the, you know, the superstars in that arena. Because as I said on that show, the reason that our conference at Wisconsin was so prescient is we spent a lot of those 13 hours, which is those 6 or 8 discs that are there, discussing, and then I lavishly illustrated, you know, back in the studio, all of the various aspects of the whole intelligent design argument and debate, but also with things that are not part of the normal debate, which is the whole ET factor. You know, we only have on Earth examples of life here. And every one of us, be it theologian or scientist, extrapolates from life here to life in the galaxy, life in the universe, life in the multiverse. So you got to think of this in a little different way, and that's what we discussed for hours and hours with some really amazing examples in this DVD set.
I want to take a couple calls here, Richard. People are lining up to chat with you this holiday week. But let's talk, if we can, for a second about this Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that's halfway to Mars now. I have not heard you talk about Cydonia in a long time. You have not backed down on your theory on that, have you?
Not at all.
Okay.
We just found so much other stuff elsewhere on Mars. I mean, Cydonia, the reason Cydonia is so pivotal and so important and will last in history is because of the presence of the face on Mars. Again, the face on Mars is central to this whole question vis-a-vis intelligent design, because if you look at this from a creationist point of view, or you look at this from a standard scientific point of view, biology, the idea of finding a human or humanoid face on Mars is impossible. This is one area where the theological people and the scientific people all agree that we are nuts. You know, you cannot have humans, humanoids, Homo sapiens, human ancestors, et cetera, on Mars, period. End of discussion. Go away. But we got data. We've got data that's been peer-reviewed. We've got data that's been corroborated. We've got data that survives, you know, both the peer review process as well as political polls of people who know nothing about this, shown a photograph, they say, well, damn thing looks like a face. So when we get there with this new spacecraft, this new mission, which can take pictures of things, as I said, smaller than my book, the monuments of Mars, a city on the edge of forever, if it was lying down there in the deserts of Cydonia, we will, if they give us the truth, George, if they finally bite the bullet and give us the unvarnished pictures, we will see, as I said to Hugh Ross at the conference, and this line is on the DVD set, we will see the girders making up the face, because it is a ruined, constructed structure. The fractal work says pretty clearly that's what it is. Now, I made a bet with Hugh Ross in this DVD set, where I bet him a dinner and vice versa that I would turn out to be right. And it was really interesting because after the break, Hugh came up to me and he says, can we put a time limit on this bet? Now, Hugh works, you know, he's got many hats. He's a theologian. He's a minister. Yeah. He's a congregation. He also works for Caltech, which is the parent company, if I can use that term, of JPL.
That's right.
So when he came up to me after the break, he actually said it on camera, so it's also on the DVDs. When he said, can we put a time limit on the bet? My little mind went, bing, what does Hugh know from the discussions in the back room that he knows that if he doesn't put a time limit on the bet, he can lose, meaning that there is life, there was ancient intelligent life that looked like us, which is the big thing that should not be on the planet Mars. So, no, I am absolutely 150% unequivocally not backing down. There was life on Mars. It did look like us, and as I've said very forthrightly, the way I read this data is we were or are the Martians, with all that, that entails for both conventional history as well as our theological projections, which is why the whole intelligent design conversation now and what we put on film and tape and put out in this DVD set is so incredibly timed, particularly for this Christmas before things get really interesting.
I'm going to give that number out again before you're off the air with us.
Okay.
Let's take some calls and, again, some exciting times ahead of us for many of the things that you've researched, Richard. Wildcard Line, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jeremy from Seattle.
Jeremy, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
I want to say it's a pleasure. There's no one on the radio that sounds like a friend when you hear them talking to other people. Richard, I've heard you on a couple of times. Be the only person that might actually think this makes any sense. I have an idea. If we could tunnel around the world, say every 500 miles, every 250 miles, a tunnel that would be, I don't know, a mile across, made up of other tunnels that could expand and contract, but the center cores would be solid, vacuumless. Do you think that could provide a different way of transportation so that we could? But I know it sounds great.
No, I'm laughing because
the only. Okay, all I thought was we would have a power grid able to sustain solar power throughout the whole world, especially if we could use gradient style paints. I know somebody talked about that on your program once, and I looked it up, and it's very promising. The idea of painting something and be able to use it, use the power gradient from that type of paint. But I'll leave you with that. I mean, everything else can move forward from there. But I thought that I know it would take lots of manpower. I know it would take lots of materials. I know it's an 80-year plan or whatever. But if you could, you'd have travel. You could do your show in Los Angeles and you could live in Beijing. And as crazy it is, I think you might actually see the possibility in it.
Well, look,
in the long term.
You're in very good company because an old and dear friend of mine who's no longer with us, Gene Roddenberry, who created Star Trek, in his follow-on series, Earth and Earth 2, he actually invented something like this called the sub-shuttle system, which was a network of buried tunnels with very high-speed trains, electromagnetic trains, with tunnels that were basically vacuums, so you could move at several hundred or up to 1,000 miles per hour, and you could have lunch in Beijing and dinner in Washington, D.C. So your idea is not crazy at all. The technology is not there yet, but who knows? Someday it may be required.
I got to tell you, Richard, when I was flying a Saturday from Los Angeles to St. Louis, I kept thinking, gosh, one day we're going to have a plane that will go up and down within an hour between these two cities. And
well, you know,
I think it'll happen.
It's going to happen, but it may not be a plane. It may be what my friend Tim Ventura and I are working on for a show that I'm going to propose to Lisa formally in the next few days, as soon as I do some more, you know, dotting of the I's and crossing of the T's.
Understand.
There has been a breakthrough in the anti-gravity front, which involves one of your favorite stories, the Philadelphia experiment.
Oh, really?
And we've got some real data. Tim, you know, and some scientists that he works with have put together an extraordinary story based on real physics that involves, among other things, potential anti-gravity. And when it's ready, you know, remember what Orson Welles used to say, make no wine before it's time. When it's ready, I will bring this formally to you and to Lisa, and you can make a decision if you want to go forward.
Okay.
But I think it's going to be a really cool program if you want to do it.
All right, great. As by the way, on January 12th, I'm hosting a in-demand pay-per-view show on predictions. And depending on just how successful that program might be, I threw out your name as a possible show, and there was a lot of interest in that.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
I'll keep you up to date on that.
You know, years ago, they did put one of our early tapes, the UN briefing that I did at the United Nations back in 92,
yeah,
on pay-per-view. And we ought to run a contest. How many of the audience realize the significance of the channel that they chose for it? It was channel 195.
There you go again. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with Richard C. Hoagland.
Hey,
hi there.
George. How you
hi.
Doing?
Good. Thank
Kevin
you.
Kevin from New Jersey. And hey, thanks for making the program scarier over the last couple
God,
days.
Are you George? Got,
what?
Am I scarier?
No, George. I sent him emails to make the program scarier, they must have did it because they had Dr. Doom and everybody else on. But George, Richard, I've never spoken with you before, and I've always wanted to ask you this question.
Okay.
Is it possible to take the planet Venus and shoot it up with canisters with photosynthesizing algae to turn that into oxygen so we could live there?
Yes. Carl Sagan actually published a paper on this. Oh, in fact, it was one of the papers that made Carl eventually a household word back in the 1960s.
Like a chain reaction.
Yeah, exactly, because photosynthetic bacteria living in the clouds where the temperatures are incredibly much cooler than the surface.
Right.
If you put the right organisms there, you might have to gene splice them. You might have to create them, you know, from guys that live here.
Engineer it to take the heat.
Exactly, but you could engineer a life form that would literally terraform Venus probably in a couple of hundred years.
Really eat up all the carbon dioxide?
Well, it would transform it. It would transform it into free oxygen.
Why don't we do that instead of focusing on Mars? Because all the atmosphere is going to escape from Mars.
Well, but you live in cities underground or in domes on Mars.
By the way, I think on Mars, the Cydonia, that's built by the fallen angels, those faces.
You and David Flynn have something in common then.
Yeah,
the reason I'm focused on Mars is because on Venus, we'll find nothing. Venus got resurfaced like a parking lot with asphalt, basalt, mm-hmm. about 500 million years ago, so there's nothing interesting there. Whereas Mars is like a museum. It's like a planetary
But where do you want to live if we have to leave Earth?
I'd go out instead of in.
Right. I'd probably go to Jupiter. Speaking of that, I think I actually want to go to Jupiter.
Like, ultimately, I want to go really far out, which is to other stars, and that's where the anti-gravity technology is essential.
Speaking of in, tomorrow we're doing a program on the hollow Earth.
Ah.
How about that? That fascinates me, too.
Is this with a guy from South Africa?
He's in Australia.
Australia, okay. Must be another one.
Yeah, his name's Taylor.
Uh-huh.
Kevin Taylor.
Okay. Be interesting to see what his supporting data is.
Well, you and Robin can sit back and relax and listen to the show after your Thanksgiving feast.
We're having a quiet, small get-together. Robin is cooking, and you're invited if you want to drop down from St. Louis after your dinner. And
yeah, right. I'll teleport like Morgus did to me a couple of weeks ago. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with Richard Hoagland. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, sir. Thanks.
Just want to wish you guys happy Thanksgiving right now.
Well,
I've got a real quick question for Richard.
You too. All right.
My question is, with all the private entities trying to do manned space flight privately, has anybody given the thought to maybe getting some private individuals to get together to launch a probe to the far side of the moon and look at the structures and send those photographs back? Because that would end the discussion if we were alone or not really quick.
Well, you don't have to go to the far side of the moon to do that. There's stuff all over the front side, too. It just has to, you have to get close enough to photograph it. And there are several private enterprise missions, various companies that are racing to do this, as well as some other foreign governments now. The Chinese have announced a manned landing for, I think, 2017. The Indians from India have announced their aggressive plans to go. The Japanese are looking, you know, with their unmanned technology. They've actually had a couple of moonshots that have gone around the moon, not gone into orbit, but gone around. So eventually this will come out, and that's what I'm betting on, that you cannot keep this kind of information suppressed, particularly when you get private enterprise into the mix.
So you think the disclosure will probably be within the next maybe 10 years?
There's no way to put a timetable. It could be tomorrow.
Yeah.
Politically, remember, when you're dealing with politics, you cannot make predictions because they can change in a dime. Look at the president's fortunes now versus his election a year ago. Who would have thought?
Exactly. Who would have thought? And you know what? It could have a whip-around effect. You never know.
Yep.
Never know at all. Richard, the clock's going to tick pretty soon. I only got about a minute or so to go. I also, you know, when we say thanks, and I'm going to do a lot of this tomorrow night in the program when it's officially for me Thanksgiving, but I want to, while you're here, thank you for being such a great friend and supporter of Coast to Coast, not only during my short time period here, but during Art's long tenure on the program as well. You just provide a insight, an excitement level that not many guests provide, and I'm glad you're still on this planet, my friend.
Well, thank you, George, and I want to thank you for being who you are and being where you are, and you know, for your belief and steadfastness in terms of our research. And to everybody in the country listening now, I want you to all take a moment and give thanks to whomever you want to give thanks to for where you are tonight, because we all live through an incredibly awful experience with Katrina. There are hundreds of thousands of people who are homeless, who literally are not going to have a good Thanksgiving, and all the rest of us who are, we need to take special note of who we are, where we are, why we're here, and give thanks.
You are one class act, Hoagland, let me tell you. Okay, enjoy yourself. Say hi to Robin for me, will you?
I sure will, George.
And the Richard C. Hoagland, the DVD is, of course, God, Man, and E.T., which I think it's an award winner. If you'd like to pick it up for a holiday gift, they can get it out to you in time. That's 877-345-6222, or go to theenterprisemission.com. Now, when I come back, 3 hours of open lines. You know, I debated today whether to do, you know, we did an evil hotline last week, and should we be scary this week? It's Thanksgiving night, the night of. Let's keep it light. Let's come up with some fascinating stories. We'll talk about that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.